Good morning and welcome to our Engage breakfast for this month. My name is Toya Bell. I'm the new Chief Deputy Ethics Officer at the Health and Human Services Commission, and I'm honored to welcome you today as a board member of Leadership Austin. So welcome and thank you. As a tradition, we like to start the program off by asking how many people are here for the first time. If you're here for the first time, please raise your hand. Fantastic. Thank you for joining us in this conversation today. The conversation will be about the growing divide, and as you may know, this is the fourth in a series that we've been having this year. The panel will discuss the divide that exists between our economy, specifically the wage and skill gaps. As committed citizens, stewards, and leaders, each of us have a responsibility to understand the inequalities that exist, what the consequences are because of these inequalities, and the role that we can each play in addressing change, in bridging the gaps. The breakfasts that we have are important because we value the input from all different points of view throughout our community. On your table will be instructions on how you can participate in the conversation by texting your questions in to our presenters. Please review the instructions, and we hope that you will join the conversation and the dialogue today. Issues of inequality and division are not easy to talk about, and we're so grateful that you're willing to be a part of the conversation. I'd like to say thank you to each of our partners that make the Engage Breakfast Series possible. You'll find them listed on the signage in the middle of your tables. A special thank you to our day sponsor, Workforce Solutions Capital Area, and thank you for letting me join you at your table. A special thank you to the Long Center for the Performing Arts. That's where we are today. And I also wanted to acknowledge I also serve on the board of the Long Center and have been on that board since 2001. So thank you so much for being in this beautiful space that we were able to build as a gift to the community. Thank you to KXAN and to the Engage presenting sponsor, the Austin Board of Realtors. On behalf of the board, we have their Director of Government and Community Relations, Emily Chenevert. Emily, could you come forward and share a few remarks?
Thank you. Thanks so much. Good morning, everyone. I am Emily Chenevert, the Director of Public Affairs with the Austin Board of Realtors. We are a 10,000-member-strong organization that is proud to partner with Leadership Austin. We really believe in connecting our membership and the community at large to these types of sort of difficult issues to wrestle with. And so with that, I would just encourage you to kind of dig in this morning, enjoy the conversation, and take home what you can on this important topic. With that, I'll turn you back over to your program, and we appreciate your opportunity to speak with you.
Thank you so much. I'm Robert Hadlock from KXAN and I'd like to welcome you here this morning. Our team from KXAN is here over here at the table, headed by our president and general manager, Eric Glassberg. We are big believers in this event and what we're trying to accomplish, get more information out there to the public, and we're glad you're all here for that. It's an honor to be here. We're here often about the strong economy here in Austin, our population growing faster than any other large city in the country, and we have an unemployment rate significantly below the national average. However, we also know that there are skills and wage gaps that perpetuate and divide our region. What are the inequalities that surround both the cause and effects of these gaps, and how do we work towards a more equitable workforce? Well, this is what we're here to discuss today, and I'm excited to be joined by our esteemed panel. We're privileged to have a city council member in each of these discussions about Austin's growing divide, and today we're joined by Greg Kassar, who represents District 4 in Austin and serves on the Economic Opportunity, Technology, Innovation, and Creative Industries Committee. That's a big one. Councilmember Kassar is a native Texan, the son of Mexico, and immigrants, and previously served as policy director at Workers Defense Project, where he spearheaded campaigns that won major policy reforms to improve wages, education, and workplace safety across Austin, and that garnered national attention. Brian Kelsey is principal and founder of Civil Analytics, a research and consulting firm that helps turn complex data into usable information. Today, he'll be drawing upon his deep understanding of our region's economy to help us talk through causes and solutions about the divide we are seeing in our workplace. Also here this morning is Steve Jacobs. Steve is the executive director of Capital Idea. That's an organization that lifts working adults out of poverty and into living wage careers through education. He has served in this role since founding, in 1998, and he previously worked for 10 years with the Texas Industrial Areas Foundation and Austin Interfaith on initiatives and public policy of interest to low-income families. And finally, on behalf of a very important piece of the dialogue, that would be you, is my KXN colleague, Chris Sadeghi. He represents your voice in this discussion today, and we'll be sharing a little inside joke. And we'll be sharing your thoughts and questions submitted through text messaging. Please join the conversation today by texting 22333 and entering ENG 1415 at the beginning of your question. And these instructions are in the middle of your tables there. Let's set the scene for you. And Brian, can you help paint the picture of Austin's economy and divides that are most prevalent right now?
Sure. How's the volume? I was told I have to speak very closely to this thing. Good? Okay. There are a couple different dimensions you have to understand in order to really sort of wrap your head around the reality in the labor market today. There are probably many more than this, but there are really two that are kind of driving it. One is the gap between the well-educated and those without a completed post-secondary degree. And then the other one is how that inequality translates to inequality along race and ethnicity lines. So let me just put some numbers to that, and maybe that'll help kind of frame this. People with a bachelor's degree in Austin, what would you guess their average wage is? Bachelor's degree. So not just recent grads, but kind of everybody all the way up. 80K. It's about $94,000 a year before benefits. The average wage is about $94,000 a year. For people who have a completed high school diploma, so bachelor's $94,000, high school diploma $47,000 a year. So there's a huge gap between those who have completed high school and those who have completed a bachelor's degree. Now, how does that translate to inequality along race ethnicity lines? Well, because we have an educational attainment divide here, that shows up very prominently in wages. At the top of the scale, those best educated in the region on average are Asians. Asians here on average make about $74,000 a year. On the other end of the spectrum are African American residents of Austin, making on average about $39,000 a year. So you can see kind of the gap between those who are kind of fully prepared to participate in Austin's growing economy and those who aren't, and kind of how that translates into other kinds of divides that we're seeing here.
How do you see this playing out in your new job?
Jordan, this is on already? All right. Good morning, everybody. I would have made an April Fool's joke, but I'm way too sleepy to do that right now. Maybe I will at some point in one of my answers. So there is clearly an economic divide across our city and different parts of our city. Just to orient you towards where my district is, it starts at 51st Street and runs up to Breaker Lane on the north end, straddling both sides of I-35 from Lanier High School over to the historic St. John neighborhood. So it's a very diverse district, but the median family income in my district is in the low 30K range, $33,000, $34,000 a year, and is the lowest median family income of any of the districts besides District 3. We don't arm wrestle each other over who has the lowest median family income, but we're known as the two districts that have that lowest income. But we are also the district with the most families and the most children of any district. We're almost 20% children under the age of 12 in my district, whereas in the Central City District here in District 9, it's closer to 4 or 5%. And so we are the future of the city in many ways. And so figuring out how we prepare and empower folks in districts like my own and working class and middle class people and young people all across the city to participate in the future economy rather than just purely being substituted by newcomers. Newcomers are an important piece of this city. 33% of my district are non-citizens, so obviously we're not even born in the United States. So it's not. But how do we create an economy such that those that currently live here and that are going through high school or that are working everyday jobs are able to move upward and we don't become a city of despair but remain a center of aspiration and hope that I think is what people really love about this city and why folks came here in the first place. So I know we'll have lots of other questions to discuss this, but basically, from my position, my vantage point, I know that there are certain policy-related issues, but then there are real political issues that we have to tackle and come to grips with so that the productivity and the growth that is so much a part of this city is more evenly shared, and we can make sure that we have a future of prosperity where folks in my district believe and know that that prosperity is something that's accessible to them.
Steve, let me get your perspective.
I'm going to try and... there we go. What Brian said is right, is, you know, there are kind of three things that are going to raise that or diminish that gap, both the economic gap and then the sort of the ethnic gap, and it's education, and the third thing that's going to do that is education. Now, we're fortunate that we're in a city and a community that highly values education. From K through graduate school and pre-K, we're in a community that invests in education. Even as the folks in the Capitol may be cutting back, voters in the last round chose to invest more in their school systems and the community college. And we're going to need to do more of that. That's the sobering news. Now, the good news is it pays off. Our business is to get adults through the community college into careers like nursing and technology. Those are growth fields. In just the 19 occupations that we prepare people for, there are 3,000 openings a year. These require less than a bachelor's degree. But, like Brian said, they do require a completed degree. A two-year degree from ACC in nursing or technology will get you good money. You know, sharing with folks that we had our recent starting wage. I'm not going to tell you the highest one we had because that's an outlier. $38 an hour for a two-year degree in dental hygiene. It's tough, though. You got to get through anatomy and physiology, and you got to be good, and you got to have the chemistry, and you got to have the biology. So our community is going to be called on to make more of those investments, but there's a big payoff for it.
What are some of the causes of the income gaps that we're seeing?
So I guess I can start.
Absolutely.
Inequality has always been with us. What has changed is the experience of trying to get by in the labor market in Austin, say, 20 years ago, and what it looks like today. Obviously, wealth has grown in Austin. You just have to kind of pick your head up and look around and see that we are probably a much more wealthy community. I'm from North Carolina. I moved here in 2002. My wife is a Texan. She got to Austin in 94. And we talk about this a lot. And she says, you know, when I was getting out of college and living here in the 90s, things just felt different. We didn't feel as kind of unequal as we do today. And so I'm kind of trying to wrap my head around kind of what is that? Why do things feel more unequal today? And I think part of that answer is how the economy has changed. Imagine a graph of average earnings back to, say, 95 or 96, all the way up to today. And imagine it broken down by education or broken down by race, ethnicity. You go back to 96, and the gaps between the top lines on that graph and the bottom lines were much narrower. We had a much more equal labor market. And to just put some numbers to that, back in 96, the difference between a bachelor's degree and a high school diploma average wage was about $22,000. So, and all this is adjusted for inflation. So in today's money, it was about $22,000. Fast forward to today, and that gap has more than doubled at $46,000. And if you imagine that line chart, in the late 90s, for people with a bachelor's degree plus, it's all the way up through PhDs, there was a really dramatic upward trajectory of that line in terms of average earnings. It spiked $10,000, $12,000 per year on the average as we went up to 2000 before we entered that recession. So a lot of this has just been we started out unequal, right? But a lot of it has been the way the economy has evolved. I mean, as we have kind of developed into a leading technology center in the country, you know, that obviously brings with it some return on education, and that has helped accelerate that gap and make it a lot wider. Now, while wages haven't really grown for too many people up and down the spectrum the last 10 years, the gap has persisted, and we haven't really been able to close it much.
Well, let me ask Greg, what are some of the strategies currently in action to address this issue at the city level?
Sure. So, in my view, you know, I don't think you have to be a diehard Occupy Wall Street activist to realize that we're probably in a period of history that we're the wealthiest country probably ever that has ever existed at this current time. But, you know, at the same time, we have lots of folks that are having trouble paying the rent or filling their car up with gas. And at previous points in our history, we have been able to partner the working people with their businesses and their government to make sure that businesses are also participating in training their workforce and taking sort of a high road approach to having high investments in human capital that drive large amounts of investments in workers, and therefore workers that can demand higher wages. And that's how we've traditionally built the middle class in this country. But with a global and changing economy and just tons of creative destruction, we are struggling with how to do that now at a local level, especially when we have a federal government that not only doesn't pass very much but doesn't vote very much on new bills, a state government that only meets once every couple of years, and now as sort of a local municipality, we're trying to sort out how do we deal with this problem in Austin with the limited tools that we have. In my view, some of the best things that we can do is address people's everyday cost of living, because you know, for somebody to participate in Capital Idea or to enrich themselves or their families with education, they need to not have to be pulling a second job. So addressing our escalating housing costs, I think, is a really high priority for dealing with inequality. And, you know, just the cost of transportation and the time for transportation, I think, are some of the best economic development strategies that we can have. I think that it was pretty loud and clear in this last election that selling the farm to bring a racetrack to Austin was not the kind of economic development that I think Austinites want to see or care about. They want, sort of as Jim Hightower's was always really great at saying, not to look at sort of the Dow Jones Index, but the Doug Jones Index. How are everyday people doing, and how are we participating and working hard as a government to make sure that everyday people are making it?
Steve, how can the private sector, just address what he said there.
There are two things. One is the education, the other is the politics that come with it. Because folks, when they get education, become more active and become more engaged, as you all are. There'll be kind of more people here at the next breakfast with that. How can businesses help us get there? It needs to be a win-win for business. So let's make it a win-win for business. A key part of someone now, and this is something that's changed in the 20 years we've been doing this, is there's really no such thing as an entry-level job. You go and apply for an entry-level job, the first question is, well, how many years of experience do you have doing this? Well, how do you get your experience? You can't get your first job. The solution is internships, and not just, you know, one or two for, you know, two for the Caltech people and two for the Stanford people and two for the MIT people, but dozens for the community college people. And it's a win-win for employers because they're interested in, you know, value for their labor, shall we say. So for a period of time, someone will be earning a less than family wage, perhaps, for a large family, but they'll be providing valuable input to businesses, especially in things like IT, where they need a lot of hands on deck for a lot of projects. So that's something that we're going to be focusing on over the next several years in this community, is how do employers provide win-win, meaningful internships? Call them what you will, earn and learn, co-op learning, collaborative learning, work study, just work experience for students.
And Brian, the new UT Medical School has some opportunities for Austin.
Yeah, absolutely. It's going to be a huge opportunity. Now, the question is whether or not we take advantage of it. I think up until now, Obviously, I mean, this is a kind of a once-in-a-generation opportunity. And up until now, you know, we've heard a lot of, you know, this sort of kind of loose talk about innovation districts and all this kind of stuff. And, it ends up in 9 times out of 10 kind of turning into a real estate discussion. You know, where are we going to draw the lines downtown? Where are the district boundaries going to be? You know, what are these buildings going to look like? And all, I mean, all that's important. But I think it'll be a shame if we kind of let that opportunity go by without being a little more intentional about trying to train people for the kinds of jobs that are going to be offered in that brand new medical school. And it's nothing we have to come up with on our own. There have been examples all over the country of kind of huge new anchor institutions, maybe not medical schools, but similar, a lot of healthcare, where before dirt even turned, you know, you kind of looked at the staffing pattern, the kinds of jobs that may be available at that medical school. You go to organizations like the one Steve runs and says, well, you know, we're expecting X number of healthcare technicians. Can we start to train people now for it? Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I think it's a little bit of an open question about, whether or not we're going to take kind of full advantage of this, but I hope so.
And I think a perfect example of how city government can get involved in that, you can actually see right across the river, the towers going up right there next at the end of 2nd Street, the development being built there by Trammell Crow, where the Thomas Green water treatment plant previously was. The city owned that land, sold that land, and negotiated on behalf of the public to make sure and partner with that development firm that we had affordable housing being built on the site, so brand new residences being built that will be affordable to some middle-class families, and making sure that the thousands of workers that are building that, who are residents of our city from all across our city, are being paid a decent wage, and then also have a scale and a ladder upward based on training. And there's a 20% sort of set aside that there's a pretty firm goal that the city's regularly checking up on, that the developer and the contractors working there are partnering with local workforce development centers to bring people up from high poverty zip codes. And so that's the kind of model that we should be looking at when we are talking about partnering government with economic development, with, you know, trying to bridge this gap with our local workforce.
Well, we need carpenters, we need plumbers, electricians, nurses. What does this bode for those who may have a liberal arts degree, an English degree, a history degree, Steve?
It's good news because there's a little bit of discussion about, well, not everyone needs to go to college. Wrong. Everyone needs to go to college, including your plumber. And your college student needs to learn something about technology, too, because the key to success is not simply what you know, but your ability to communicate, your ability to think critically, your ability to solve problems, your ability to figure something out when no one knows it. I mean, look, just walk into the restrooms here. I mean, you got to know electronics to turn on the faucet, right? And half the time they don't work, so it's clearly, you know, we need some electronic plumbers with that. But again, we come back to it's going to cost us. ACC is the most important workforce trainer, especially for those innovation district jobs, the medical school jobs. But the cost of tuition for a student doesn't cover the cost of the actual instruction in those technical fields. Yes, in a class like business studies where it's chalk and talk, you know, a teacher in a classroom, but no, where it's an occupation where you need laboratories and specialized equipment and training and smaller ratios and so on and so forth. So going back to the investment that we're going to be called on to make in our education system from K through at least 14.
Thank you for those reassuring words. And we have KXAN's Chris Sadeghi here with your questions.
Yeah, we have a bunch of questions in already, so I'm just going to grab a couple here. First one asks the role of parents, that if an education is so important, what are we doing for parents to stress that to their children, motivate them at an early age so that they are set up for success in the future? Second question asks, why is every solution a white-collar solution, and mentions the medical school? How's that supposed to help people with only a high school degree? Another one also mentioned, for people who need income, they may not have an opportunity to do an internship or not may not be afforded the ability to do that. So why does it seem like everything out there is a white-collar solution?
Why don't you start with the income question, the last one? about the wraparound services kind of required to get somebody through?
Well, let's kind of talk about the white collar, and there really is no purely white collar. There's no purely blue collar, and you'll hear pink collar and you'll hear green collar. But the truth is that there has to be kind of a broader platform of skills, and particularly the soft skills for people, in order to succeed in the economy. So the technical education required is part of it. The higher level, if you will, or the more analytical disciplines are important. But I don't think you can train people without a degree that requires speech and communications and English and psychology, even if it's also requiring anatomy and physiology and microbiology. I don't know if that answers the question, and I guess they'll text you if it did or not.
Wait, hey, can you say one more thing about the kind of the support services required to get somebody through?
I guess one of the questions was, well, how, if you don't have all these things, do you get through? Well, you can get through, but we are going to have to do more than simply provide education, especially for a working parent that's going to ACC and going to ACC full-time. Actually, it doesn't cost that much money. I'm sending my daughter to college and got the college bill recently, and I'm not going to tell you how much it is. But for $4,000 or $5,000 a year over 3 or 4 years, you can take someone who is making $14,000 and get them ready for something that's making $42,000 a year. And that's the cost of tuition, but also child care, transportation if needed, emergency assistance. Most importantly, someone that will play the role that in a middle-class college-educated family, that middle-class college-educated parent plays. Someone that knows how the system works and can guide them through. There was a question about parents and what can parents do. Well, parents who don't have education, and I come from a family where my mom wanted to go to college, didn't have the chance. My dad had a year at the University of Minnesota, and then he had to quit because his family ran out of money. So they knew education was important. They knew grades were important. They knew savings were important. But that's it. They didn't know what a FAFSA was or SAT. So it took teachers, sort of accidental connections with teachers, for us to find the people that guided us through that. Well, you need to put that kind of institutionalized in place for folks. So
I'll say two things on the parent role. We need to do a better job of talking about career and technical education. For some unknown reason, a lot of people still think, when they hear career and tech education, they still think a shop class or, you know, something like it existed last in the, you know, in the 70s. And so there's that. And then the other part of that is, you know, we get into this sort of unfortunate either or sort of dynamic when it comes to career and tech education at the secondary level. People feel like, you know, making room for it may detract from kind of the focus on straight to four-year university. And that's a shame because, you know, I don't care if your daughter is going to Harvard and majoring in English. Having exposure to different kinds of disciplines and maybe even a structured internship program at a place like Samsung or IBM is only going to help her make informed decisions once she goes on to Harvard to get that English degree. So, it's unfortunate to me that we're in this sort of, you know, it's either straight to four-year or it's career and technical education. One somehow detracts from the other. It's just kind of an unfortunate dynamic because the answer really should be both.
Sure, and I'll just touch base briefly on the question of parents, because before I sort of got into the community organizing world and also the world of politics, I was in school to be a high school teacher. And had a great class, was co-teaching at the University of Virginia, and one of my very favorite students, fantastic, wonderful woman, she sometimes showed up to school looking really tired. Most of the kids usually did. But I found out about halfway through a semester of my junior year of college that she was getting driven to school in the same car that she was sleeping at night and with her parents. And it's those sorts of we have to understand and accept the fact that the vast majority of parents care about their kids and care about their kids' education just as much as anybody, as you yourself probably do. And so however the city and however our local government and state government can provide folks with the resources to support their kids and support their kids' dreams, that's so critically important, even if they aren't going to be able to go back to college or even be able to go back to get a secondary degree. We just postponed a contract for our water utility, where traditionally the custodial services at the water utility have been performed by full-time employees with health care and benefits. And there was a contract to outsource 50 of those jobs. And the city staff report came back saying all full-time employees will be receiving equal pay and all sorts of benefits, just like city employees. So we submitted a question, well, how many of the 50 employees are full-time? And they said 5 out of the 50, 45 part-time. So obviously they would not be receiving any of those things. So we have to be thinking about the effects that anchor institutions like the city have on our labor market and then how that impacts people's ability to educate their kids, put food on the table so that their kids can succeed and can thrive. Because a lot of people whose doors I knocked on, they didn't care whether I was coming to promise them social mobility or promise them a better life or a better wage, but they cared about their ability to make sure that their kids' lives were better. And so I feel like that's the task of my generation and of this council, to make sure that future generations can find a way upward.
Yeah, be careful with these liberal arts comments up here. You got at least one liberal arts major, you know, sitting up here on the panel. I don't know what you guys majored in college, but well, we're not all bad.
No. Let me just add, too, that the family is also the biggest ally in this effort. Because if you educate the parent, they're going to know how to get their kids through. And we're seeing that with our graduates. And I'm thinking of one person in particular, Irene Casillas, she worked at Angie's over there on the east side. She was a waitress. She's now a registered nurse. She's Hispanic. Got her degree. Then she got her brother, her sister. Chased one of her nieces back in for a GED and got the other two nieces to go to ACC as well. So especially in that emerging majority of Hispanic families, in African-American families, the networks are powerful allies for the education system to get the job we're wanting the system to do, which is educate the next generation. So we've got some advantages in all these things that we're talking about today. There's opportunity here, including for those businesses that are interested in more opportunities.
Chris, you got another?
Yeah, one just came in. Could you talk about the pros and cons of a local minimum wage law?
Can I start?
Go for it.
There are a couple things from a policy perspective that we could do that would obviously help. You know, there's some question about, you know, whether or not we should pursue things, you know, like trying to increase the minimum wage with the almost near, not even near certainty, you know, definite certainty that the legislature, you know, would never let kind of one city sort of single-handedly,
they've already preempted it,
raise the minimum wage to a living wage. That does not mean we should stop talking about it. You know, I get frustrated sometimes. We can talk politics a little bit, right? I get frustrated sometimes when, you know, people start to circulate ideas about what we could do in Austin, and somebody, just like I just did, says, well, the legislature will never let us do that. And the only way we really even start to chip away at it is to talk about it more. And, you know, I think there's a lot of work we could do to talk about kind of what is the difference between the minimum wage and a living wage, depending on family type and that sort of thing, and talk openly kind of about the pros and the cons and what would happen if we did that. So that's one example. Another policy example, and this is a quick one, is universal pre-K. You know, it's I just read this morning, so I may be not quite right with the details here. We're leaving about $8 billion on the table in the House budget. And one of the amendments that came through on universal pre-K had the cost estimate to do it statewide at $1.6 billion. So we could do universal pre-K many times over, and we're choosing not to. So, you know, there are a lot of things that could help the household budget that don't just directly involve education that could contribute to the solution. But, you know, honestly, you know, I have to question whether or not we're even serious about doing it.
There's a perception among many folks that Austin is lacking in mid-level, mid-wage jobs. Is that accurate?
Brian, we talked about this. You go for it.
I'll be quick. No.
Okay.
It's not accurate. But there's obviously a caveat here. If you look at all, you know, the metropolitan areas across the country, about 365 of them or so, Austin is one of the leaders in middle wage job creation. There's this, I don't know where this narrative started, but you hear this, people say this a lot. You know, we're kind of creating a lot of jobs on the high end, and we're creating a lot of jobs on the low end, and we're not creating anything in between. That's absolutely not true. We are creating jobs kind of up and down the spectrum. The question is middle wage enough anymore in Austin? I mean, middle wage, we used to kind of define as sort of 22, 24 an hour. 24 an hour, you kind of look at rents in central Austin these days, and 24 an hour ain't going to get you very far. So I think the better question is not so much kind of are we creating middle wage jobs, it's are we creating middle wage jobs for Austin? And that's a different matter.
I'd say another important point is, are we creating those middle wage jobs that young Austinites coming out of high school may be able to feel like they're going to someday be able to attain? You know, there's been a lot of conversation about the resurgence of manufacturing in Texas and bringing manufacturing jobs to Austin. And it's always been throughout history, or my reading of it, that those manufacturing jobs become middle wage and dignified jobs because of partnerships with the community and with the government. You know, manufacturing jobs at first were those jobs you would lose your hand doing, or that kids under the age of 13 would do. And so we need to make sure that those manufacturing jobs that we bring here are accessible by the community and are dignified jobs that folks would be proud taking and have a ladder upward into.
Chris, another question.
Yeah, one question asks, do we have a skills gap by people or a training gap by employers?
Why don't you go, Steve?
Both. The problem in the American system of training is it's you train them, I'll steal them. Right? If you're an employer and you need trained workers, you're going to be really smart and you're going to invest in your workers, you're going to get them through work and through college or whatever, and then the guy across the street's going to offer them a buck hour or more, and they go away. So there's this kind of built-in disincentive for employers to invest in their workforce because they can't capture the benefits reliably enough. So then it falls back on a community-wide solution to invest so that any individual employer's not disadvantaged by making a big investment, but all are equally sharing in the cost of creating someone who has a higher value for the community as a whole. So,
two things. One, employer engagement's a tough one. If you talk to employers, everybody kind of nods and says, oh, yeah, you know, we would love to train local people for these jobs. But, you know, when it comes down to it, most employers don't really care where their employees come from to fill new jobs. They care, can they get the best at the price they can afford, and will they do a good job? You don't necessarily care if they move here from Phoenix or New York or D.C. or if they already live here. You know, obviously, if you're paying relo, you might. But how many companies really do that these days? So, you know, we need to kind of have a more honest conversation about what, you know, employer engagement looks like. And, you know, the other thing I'd say is, you know, where's Sean Moran? Sean Moran, raise your hand. Sean runs the Geographic Information Systems program at ACC. And Sean's done a great job kind of deliberately creating bridges to employers for those GIS students to get over this experience gap that Steve's talking about. And everybody kind of likes to beat up community colleges sometimes. Like, oh, you know, you're not offering the right certificates, you're not offering this and that. And as soon as you do, you know, you take the 18 months to actually stand up the program, employers turn around and say, well, we really want people with 3 to 5 years work experience. So Sean is trying to very intentionally bridge that gap by getting that experience through internships, through doing project-based work in the curriculum for employers. So when you leave with that associate's degree, you can honestly say, look, here's my portfolio, and now I have 2 years of work experience. So now I can get past that barrier asking for a number of years of work experience.
And I would, you know, tag along to your point that it's not that employers don't want to necessarily do that training, but of course don't want to be at a competitive disadvantage. And the city has our own set of values, and they're chosen by voters when they elect their elected officials to implant those sorts of set of values. And we are an anchor institution with a lot of purchasing power that have the ability to say these are our standards, and therefore we don't put any employers at a competitive disadvantage if we set that standard across the board in various contracts that we put out or license agreements that we put out. You know, we're a $3.3 billion institution that actually supposedly has the values of the community at heart and in mind. And so we can pass those values along if our elected leaders and our city staff and our voters are you know, in line with that.
We have had a lot of talk about high school and college students. What about folks in their 50s and 60s who are still capable of working hard, who maybe have lost their jobs or are underemployed? How big of a problem in Austin is that? We don't hear much about that.
There's no such thing as lifetime employment and security anymore. I mean, so everyone at every stage in their life has to be ready to kind of learn again what they need to in order to be employed and employable. Now, the good news is those folks in their 50s, have the maturity and the soft skills and all those other things that they've learned over the years, and it's just a matter of providing the technical skills. And with the motivation, they can. I see Hector Aguilar here. They run a program for getting folks up really quick on coding Java. Well, we need a lot of that, and it pays a lot. It's hard work, and it's not for everyone, but it's there. But that's going to be the part is... You can no longer have the expectation that because I'm, 50 years old, I've reached sort of this level of security. There's just no safe spot anymore. But there are opportunities all along the way.
Chris?
A lot of these questions are asking about some of the internships you mentioned are unpaid. So if there is a young person who wants to get those skills, yet they have to make ends meet, they have to pay for transportation, parking, how do they reconcile that? And another one asks, as far as the businesses are concerned, should we be incentivizing or encouraging them to offer those internships and training and also to hire local rather than out of state?
Let me just quickly, and then we'll go to Greg. The internships have to be paid. And that's unpaid internships. You're going to get what you pay for, number one. Number two, they're increasingly legally complex for employers. And the three is it doesn't give people the work experience that Sean was, needs his students to have. So we're going to have to bite the bullet and either sort of sub-market wages for students or collective. Garrett Groves was telling me there's a state program for 7,000 work-study positions, but primarily inside the higher education institutions, not really outside. Well, it has to be expanded to outside. So,
I'm not sure if... Now all of a sudden I'm about to start answering something you said, but I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, so if you'll repeat it.
The incentivizing businesses offering training and also hiring local.
Absolutely, and we have to be strong about that in the ways that we can at the city. We have a MBEWB program, which is for minority-owned businesses, women-owned businesses, and small businesses when we contract. And that's, I think, also very important. Incentivizing hiring of local workforce from particular census tracts or zip codes that need it, but also encouraging and supporting our small businesses. Every time we walk back off of the dais and the boxes of sandwiches behind there for us are from Jason's Deli, I just can't believe why we are, we have so much great talent here, and that we just need to be utilizing that as a community as much as we can and encouraging that, incentivizing it. And so sometimes you talk about requiring it, but really, once again, what that means is setting a standard so that everybody is playing on that level playing field.
And we already are to some extent. You get bonus points in the evaluation process for incentives if you're doing workforce training and that sort of thing. But I think we could be a lot more creative. I sat on the task force that rewrote the economic development policy last time the city of Austin did it. People told us, well, you know, if you do a formal cost benefit study, it's gonna scare employers away. Well, if we do public hearings where people can comment on the deal before it's done, it's gonna scare businesses away. I'm not so sure that any of that's actually happened. So, I think there's probably other things we could do. I've always wondered if there was a way through the policy to do things like housing and transportation subsidies. And maybe even kind of a stronger local hire incentive within the policy. And whether that's kind of through workforce training or just in general, I don't know. But I think there's a lot more we could do to be creative through our policy because, I mean, we've got a lot of bargaining power.
Yeah.
And Austin's, we're one of the leading economies in the country and people want to be here and we should take advantage of that.
And there have been, cities across the country that have taken a step further and partnered those employers directly with nonprofit groups within their cities. We have so many people here who I know are, working to do this day in and day out, and instead of having to go chase around employers, instead for that connection to be made directly through the city, not just when we're giving the big 380 deal incentives, which are the ones that you see in the newspaper, but all of the different sorts of ways that the city helps support our local business community, we can make sure that that business community is also supporting our local workforce at the same time and encouraging and incentivizing and even paying for that, I think is something worthwhile that the community would be supportive of doing right now.
Yeah, these last two questions are somewhat related. One asks, are there opportunities outside of healthcare and IT in Austin? And the second mentions Brownwood, Texas, population of 20,000, has 3M, American Standard, a bunch of manufacturing jobs. Is there a spot for manufacturing jobs and business in Austin?
You want to do the first one?
Repeat the first question.
Are there opportunities outside of healthcare and IT?
Yes. I mean, the trades that we talked about is a big one, but again, plumbing isn't what it was, for my dad. He was a pipe fitter all his years, and he wouldn't recognize, what pipe fitters have to do now. Those would be the big three, IT or technology in general, the trades, healthcare. Manufacturing is a possibility, and I'll turn that over to Brian.
So manufacturing is a possibility, but there are plenty of jobs in other industries, white collar jobs, that are managerial supervision positions of office workers and things, other kind of administrative jobs that pay enough to kind of meet that living wage standard. So it's not to say that it's all healthcare or it's all tech, or anything like that. There's a broad spectrum in other sectors. Manufacturing here, we've kind of reached sort of a point of stability. After a long time of steady kind of downward trajectory, losses in manufacturing, we've kind of evened out a little bit here, and the nature of manufacturing has changed, which is challenging for this because firms are smaller and leaner. And doing anything kind of in a structural kind of work study internship, that's always more difficult with smaller firms than it is with larger firms. So, yeah, I think manufacturing offers plenty of possibilities to do these programs.
And just to add, manufacturing is now a skilled occupation. It's not an unskilled occupation. It is a skilled occupation. I was reading about some of those manufacturing plants in South Carolina that, make stuff for BMW. Those guys got to know calculus to run those machines. But they do, and they make a lot of money, and those machines work well.
What role can collaborations play between public, private, and community-based organizations?
I think that something we haven't discussed as much is chronic unemployment in some of our communities where we have lots of folks with criminal offenses in their past. That is something that is really deeply affecting some segments of our community. But there are lots of employers who I think would participate in a community-wide effort that we can target some of that chronic unemployment because, once again, we may show the number of people unemployed in Austin continuing to decrease. But when you actually segment that out and look at particular communities, there's a lot of issues that we're still facing there, and that's something that I think is a community-wide effort that people, once again, I think there's the will right now to handle that between a political solution and then partnerships with community-based groups and businesses that are looking for skilled and trained employees?
Yeah, there's a lot we could do. I've been getting more interested lately in this concept of community schools. And so I just joined the board of this nonprofit called the Austin Project. And it's, you know, part of it is the idea that, you know, we're really never going to get very far unless we start to address in a more kind of holistic manner families. And, you know, they've got these kind of family resource centers they run in partnerships with schools to try to really meet needs kind of across the continuum for families. Mm-hmm. And it's not just about what happens in the walls of a school. So that's one thing, you know, they've had some success with it at Reagan, I think, and some other places. And I'm getting more and more interested in that. But again, this requires being very intentional. It requires a very kind of clear understanding of costs. Steve got some great numbers kind of for what it would cost to scale his program. And, you know, sometimes I just it's frustrating because we're not willing, I think, to kind of state the facts. You know, we think that, you know, the Austin economy is just going to kind of grow and sort of take everybody along with it. And we're not too honest about kind of how intentional we actually have to be to make sure that that happens.
And I just want to say that those partnerships are essential. They're critical. They're inescapable. Workforce Solutions is here. Alan, Tamara, Joine. Businesses need neutral places, honest brokers, where they can discuss their collective issues, collective needs, and access kind of the rest of us. If they're just left on their own, then they're all they're doing is competing with each other, and they're not. They need some places where they can talk about common issues.
Finally, question for each of you, and we'll start with Steve. What is one actionable way that folks here in the room today can make an impact?
Get ready for 2016. This November, Austin Community College came to us with three propositions, and we passed two. Those two are bonds that are rebuilding Highland, what used to be Mall, into Highland Campus. Has anyone been there? Coolest place on the planet. Who was there when it was JCPenney? Oh, my God, okay. The third one missed by 6,000 votes. And the third one would have funded the soft infrastructure that ACC needs, the faculty, the advisors, the additional support that we talked about, that wraparound that we talked about. ACC may be coming back in 2016, missed only by 6,000, not 250,000 votes cast. So, you know, please consider that.
I'll give you two. I kind of said my piece about living wage and pre-K, so I'll stay away from that one. Go to your employer and ask them about what they're doing in this arena. Do we offer internships? What kind of work-study programs do we have? How can we get more involved? Just go and ask. Hopefully many of you run a company, and you can start to kind of think about these things on your own. So, you know, that would be one, and then the other one would be, you know, to go, if you have kids, even if you don't, you know, go to the schools, go to the school district and say, you know, what are we doing on career and technical education? What's offered? What programs? Where are they offered? Are we offering enough? Kind of what role can CTE play in kind of broadening the education experience before people move on from high school?
Great.
I would say, be, you know, not only understand and know how important it is what your local elected officials are doing, but hold us accountable for the values that you have, especially if you deeply value, you know, closing the economic divide. I think something that I only sort of motioned towards talking about some of the demographics of my district, but now I'll say really explicitly, is that immigration reform at a federal level, whatever we can do at the state and local level, is so critical for closing the economic gap. I mean, we have so many, you know, 50% of the folks that are building our buildings will admit to a UT researcher they're undocumented. I mean, the amount of negotiating power that our citizenry is losing on a daily basis because of our failure over, you know, decades and our recent failure to even bring a bill up for a vote in Congress has been really crippling to folks in my district. And when we talk about parents that care about their kids, you know, I have lots of constituents who hopped on top of a train and risked their entire lives in order to fend for their children. Those are Austinites. These are folks that are the future of our city. And however we can handle these things on a local level, if they're not going to be handled on a federal level, I think is really critical for this issue.
What wonderful calls to action. Please join me in thanking our panel. My name is Julie Smith. I'm the program manager for the Engage Breakfast Series, and I want to thank you so much for being here this morning and being a part of this very important dialogue. There's many ways for you to be involved with us at Leadership Austin, and I want to take a few minutes just to tell you about a few of them. We've got many alumni in the room. Will you raise your hand if you're an alumni? These people also have on bright neon stickers. They're hard to miss. These folks have been through our Emerge and our Essential program. We're currently recruiting for those programs, so if you're interested, please talk to our alumni, grab a staff person, one of our board members. We'd love to talk to you. We've got recruitment events coming up this spring, so keep your eyes out. We'll be sending out emails about that. We also have our best party ever coming up, and if you haven't been, I promise you, it is the best party ever. Absolutely. That party's on May the 8th at the AT&T Center. Early bird tickets are now on sale, so get them while you can at $100. Those prices go up on April the 8th, so make sure to check that out. We have volunteer opportunities as well. We've got some people out in the lobby that can talk to you about that. So put that on your calendar, May 8th. Also, we'll be continuing this series about the growing divide on May the 6th with a discussion about our social sector and how health and human services organizations are helping to address this challenge of the growing divide in our city, some of the challenges they're facing, and some pretty innovative things that are on the horizon there. So we hope to see you again soon. Thanks again for being here. Have a great day.